Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Today, the president took aim at U.S. intelligence officials. He disputes assessments on Iran and other global threats. According to him, quote, the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers of Iran. They're wrong. They're testing rockets last week and more and are coming very close to the edge. Their economy is now crashing, which is the only thing holding them back. Be careful of Iran. Perhaps intelligence should go back to school, end quote. Mainstream corporate media is painting this as Trump has gone off the rails again. How can he challenge the leaders of the intelligence apparatus in this country? Well, who's right and who's wrong here? If the leaders of the intelligence apparatus in this country are infallible, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Well, anyway, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the World, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. He served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, his duties including chairing the National Intelligence Estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's five most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 85. He co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose how intelligence was being falsified to justify the war in Iraq. Ray McGovern, as always, Ray, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. Great to be with you.
Thanks, sir. So is my premise sound? I mean, mainstream media is making this out to be that Trump, once again, going to Twitter and is just nuts. How can he question CIA Director Gina Haspel or Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats or the others as though they're infallible and saying nothing but the truth?
Well, because John Bolton told them to.
Oh, thank you, Ray. Okay, let's move to our next guest. Go ahead, man.
No, it's, you know, it's really quite remarkable. I don't know who foisted John Bolton onto President Trump, but the only thing they really, really agree on is Iran, and they're both wrong. Now, Bolton did everything he could to attack Iran when he had position of power. It's on the record. We need to attack Iran, okay? And, mind you, so did Dan Coats. Now, this goes back 10 years or so, but Dan Coats was in with Bolton and the others, all calling for an attack on Iran. So now, on Iran, we Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity have a memo to the president dating back more than a year in which we say, is Iran the prime sponsor of terrorism throughout the world? Well, if you go back 35 years, right. Now, no way. So I don't know where Bolton is making this stuff up, but Bolton famously said when he was very high in the State Department, look, you just give us what facts you have. We will do the analysis right here. Thank you very much. So that explains it, really. Bolton has this thing about Iran. So did very many people, the military as well. And what's really curious here is that I see no mention of Israel. Now, you go look through these annual assessments and see if Israel is mentioned. Well, it's not. It's almost as though Israel is the 51st state. And how can you possibly weigh what's going on in the Middle East and the intelligence on Iran without mentioning Israel? So what we have here is a pure and simple Israeli-sponsored effort to blacken Iran and to make it out to be worse than it possibly could be, given the fact that it agreed, and the UN inspectors have verified this, not to make a nuclear weapon.
One of the points that came out of this assessment was that China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea use cyber operations to, quote, threaten both minds and machines, end quote, to steal information, influence U.S. citizens, or disrupt critical infrastructure. Didn't the U.S. use the Stuxnet worm against Iran's nuclear program? And I read that it was Israel. Hey, I just mentioned it. Israel that tested the Stuxnet virus. And also, the NSA is listening in and reading emails sent from and to people all around the world. So the way that this is presented is that the United States is totally innocent of spying, totally innocent of using backdoor programs to access and to corrupt sites and networks around the world. And woe is us, all these people are doing these bad things to us.
Well, you mentioned Israel now, and if you were on NBC or CBS, you'd be off the air, man. They would find some sort of technical difficulty and go to the break.
Well, they already did. That's why I'm no longer on CNN and no longer on MSNBC.
Welcome to the club. Okay, well, here's the deal. We can't get on these programs because we look at these things in a holistic way. Now, you can't possibly talk about cyber warfare without mentioning that according to a bona fide leak to Julian Assange that was published by Julian in March of 2017, the CIA instituted a whole separate directorate. Now, in my day, there were three directorates. Now there are four. And the fourth one has to do with active cyber warfare techniques. And those allow, for example, the CIA to hack into a server or a computer, disguise who hacked in, and leave little breadcrumbs, leave little signs that it could have been, the Russians. Leave a little Cyrillic here and mention the name of the first head of the Cheka, the forerunner of the KGB. Now, we all know that Russia is blamed for hacking in, but if the CIA can do that, and the CIA uses a 34-cent word here, obfuscate, if they can obfuscate who hacked in and leave misleading signs that it was someone else, and they have the capability of this particular cyber weapon can de-obfuscate. In other words, the CIA can reconstruct what it was. So, talking about cyber warfare, you mentioned Stuxnet. Now, the only instance in history where Stux were a cyber worm was used to actually physically destroy centrifuges, this time in Iran, was through the use of Stuxnet. Now, David Sanger, who's a New York Times guy, he talked at Fordham Law School about this wonderful movie that Gibney wrote and directed, and it talks about, why it was that we employed this worm in conjunction with the Israelis. Well, it's very, very clear, and everybody's really smiling, proud of that, because the Israelis kept saying, we're going to attack Iran. They're making weapons, we're going to attack them, and we said, look, there's got to be another way. I tell you what, we'll develop this worm, and it'll never get free or anything, and we'll actually destroy physically. It's sort of like an act of war, but nobody's going to complain because we're in the United States. So we'll just do that, and then would you please not attack Iran? They bought off the Israelis by using, for the first time, a worm that destroyed things. So, for the U.S. to be pretending that it's innocent, as you suggest, and it's sort of the victim of all this, particularly with respect to so-called Russia attempts to divide American citizens, to disrupt our democracy, when there's absolutely no evidence that they actually did hack in, that's, sort of a little bit too much. Now, Wilmer, I would like to address something else you mentioned. They talk about Russia and China. Now, I take some solace from this because my first portfolio in the 60s was the Sino-Soviet dispute. And we thought, we really believed that these two countries hated each other so much that there would never, never be a reconciliation. Well, we were right for about 20 years. Now we're dead wrong.
Mm-hmm.
because there's a de facto defense alliance between Russia and China. And that's the big news. And the fact that my former colleagues there are aware of that and have told Trump, look, you know, you're not any longer, or we are not any longer, the indispensable country in the world. We were after World War II. The correlation of forces, as the Soviets used to put it, has changed. And how do I see that? Well, it has practical application, Wilmer. Take, for example, Ukraine. Now, the Chinese are allergic to changes in borders, okay? They don't like that at all for obvious reasons. And yet, when we formed a coup in Ukraine and the Russians took Crimea back, the Chinese applauded that move. Very, very different. Syria, the Chinese support Russian policy on Syria. And I dare say that if there's a dust-up in Europe, let's say, or even in Syria, between, God forbid, Russian and U.S. forces, look to the South China Sea, my friend. Look there, because I predict that the Chinese will stir up some tension there and make sure that the U.S. knows that Russia's not alone in this anymore, that there's a de facto defense alliance between Russia and China. And it could not be more different from the 60s when I got my spurs on this very ticklish problem. They are reconciled. And whose fault? It's our fault, because our policy has been really neglectful of the prospect. We've sort of put them both, the noses of both, out of joint, and they have no real other alternative than to join together. Last word on this. When I was analyzing Sino-Soviet relations, the trade went between 200 million to 400 million per annum. Okay, what's it now? It's up in the billions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there is a real change in the correlation of forces, and you know, if Trump doesn't understand that, then he really doesn't. He's proceeding on this zero-sum thing where the U.S. has more than 50% of the influence in the world, and we can work our will wherever we will. And if the Chinese are developing weapons, well, there's no thought given to the fact that, well, maybe the Seventh Fleet, maybe our array of forces out there in Japan and South Korea, maybe that has something to do with what the Chinese are doing. Now, once this sense of balance is injected, then there's a possibility someone would say, you know, there's not any real reason to contend with a warlike China. They're not warlike. They just want to protect themselves. Let's talk to them about something other than trade and come to an agreement. There's no reason why there can't be an agreement, because China does not have perpetual enmity toward our country.
Senator Angus King, the independent from Maine, was asking questions about Iran's nuclear program. And Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats said, quote, "We do not believe Iran is currently undertaking activities we judge necessary to produce a nuclear device," end quote. And then Gina Haspel, CIA director, said that at the moment, technically, they, Iran, are in compliance, end quote. Listening to Dan Coats talk about what he believed, instead of just stating what the data and the facts are, I found to be quite troubling, and even wondered if in his doing that, he's really kind of going beyond what the intelligence gathering entities are supposed to do.
Well, let's take Gina Haspel first, because the CIA is the premier analysis group on this. You know, technically in compliance is sort of like being pregnant, you know? In other words, you can't be technically pregnant.
Right.
Or pregnant.
Mm-hmm. You're either in compliance or you're not.
You're right. So they're in compliance, okay? And that's a big deal. If they're in compliance, why the heck does Trump and Bolton, of course, want to zap the Iranians? Now, what Coates is doing is, thank goodness, hewing to the National Intelligence Estimate that was written on Iran back in 2007. Wow, it's 12 years ago. Now, 3 weeks before that estimate was released, George Bush said, we have to do something about the Iranian nuclear program. They're just about to break out and get a nuclear weapon. And some reporter says, well, how soon? And Bush says, well, what do you want? World War III? Is that what you want? World War III? 3 weeks later, an honest national intelligence estimate was issued. Tom Finger was a State Department person who orchestrated this, and it said unanimously, with high confidence, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, so 4 years before the estimate, and had not resumed working. Now, that has been, I'm doing the math here, that's 12 years ago, okay? Now, no intelligence has come to us, except what the Israelis feed us, of course, that counters that judgment. And so it's very reassuring to me that despite all the pressure from the neocons and from Israel itself, the intelligence community is standing fast on this. So, number one, Iran is in compliance with the agreement, the deal that was arranged. The UN inspectors have verified that. And number two, you can't be technically in compliance. You can't be technically pregnant. You either are or you're not, and they are. And Coates is hewing to this judgment by the intelligence community. It was unanimous and it was honest. In other words, it was just the opposite of the one done in 2002 on Iraq, where they had weapons of mass destruction all over the place.
We just have about a minute. Why couldn't Dan Coates just say no? Instead of talking about what he believes or doesn't believe, when he was asked by Angus King, is Iran developing a bomb? No. All of our intelligence tells us they are not.
Yeah. Well, he's a senator, right? Or he was a senator. And then he was an ambassador, right? He's an ambassador. Well, that's the way they talk. I believe.
Okay.
So I believe that. And he left it to Gina Haspel, and to her credit, she added technically, but she told the truth. And that's a big deal.
Okay. So just real quick, getting back to what my initial question was, does the mainstream media making Trump out to be off the rails for questioning the intelligence apparatus, not to say that Trump is right, but is it a valid thing for him to do? I mean, or my point is, we should not be taking these intelligence reports on face value.
Well, as you rightly observed at the introduction here, Wilmer, the intelligence community has never been wrong. I mean, if you forget about the weapons of mass destruction and you forget about X, Y, and Z, you'll see that our record is unblemished.
And yellow cake uranium.
Yeah.
And the relationship between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, and persuading the American people, 69% of them, that Saddam Hussein had something to do with
9/11. Right.
Wow. So,
okay.
Yeah, we're wrong. They have been wrong, and the president is right in calling him to task on some of these issues and dead wrong on Iran.
Ray McGovern, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour.
Most welcome.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. We are now joined by two individuals. My first guest wrote a piece that I found on Mint Press entitled CNN Goes, Quote Unquote, Undercover to Manufacture Consent for Venezuela Coup Attempt. Even after the Trump administration announced oil sanctions, CNN still largely ignored the effect of those sanctions when it aired its undercover report another time. He's an American journalist, author, documentary filmmaker, and author at Shadowproof, Kevin Gastola. Kevin, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by a man who wrote From AFRICOM to Venezuela, Resist the White Supremacist Project, which can be found at blackallianceforpeace.com. He is a national organizer for Black Alliance for Peace, Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
It is my pleasure to be here again.
Thank you very much. Kevin, I believe that context is very important, especially if, as a journalist, one is trying to tell a story about political unrest and intervention. Why do you take issue with CNN's coverage of the U.S.-backed, if not initiated, coup attempt in Venezuela?
My answer is in your setup. There is no context to what CNN 4-minute report, quote unquote, undercover. There's no context to this. They're just there talking to people on the ground, and they take the sort of view from nowhere approach that tries to suggest that it's balanced or neutral. This is very common. Probably if you were following coverage of the government shutdown would have noticed this. They seem to believe that if they don't talk to political parties that are on opposite ends of the spectrum, so if they don't talk to Democrats versus Republicans, then they're somehow putting out a balanced or neutral report. That's the way this Venezuela, quote unquote, undercover report went. They weren't talking to Maduro camp, or they weren't talking to the people who are politicians leading the opposition. They're just talking to people caught up in the so-called middle here. And from that, we're supposed to sense that we're getting the truth of the crisis in Venezuela. This correspondent, Nick Peyton Walsh, who seems to come from an establishment background, he's a British journalist who's now working for CNN. I was drawn to dismantling this piece of really public relations video for the opposition in Venezuela because of how easy it is and how little full context there is out there for what's going on in Venezuela. They don't show the supporters of Maduro that marched in the street the same day that the opposition leader appointed himself president on January 23rd. They're not addressing the issue of sanctions. Even as hyperinflation is a problem, they're not putting it into a context and talking about how sanctions make it impossible to recover from this economic problem. And when they talk to these rank and file military people who maybe aren't happy, supposedly not happy with where they are at in Venezuela, they're not addressing the issue of what it would mean if there was a full-on military coup in this country and who would be running the country and how that would look to have the U.S. supporting a bunch of military leaders in Venezuela.
Ajamu, I think you read Kevin's piece and saw the CNN segment that he's talking about, so I want to get your take on that and also inject this. Usually when the United States goes in and takes out a leader, there's a vacuum created, and that power vacuum creates incredible mess a la Iraq, a la Libya. But now the United States maybe seems to have tried to learn from its mistakes by, as they're trying to get Maduro out, now they already have a guy teed up to try and put in place.
You know, it is really first on the incredible reporting done by your guests. That was a very important piece of putting the role of CNN in its proper context, which basically is, in essence, being the mouthpiece for the U.S. state, and exposing once again the connecting interest that the corporate media has with the militarist agenda of the state. I mean, I thought that reporting done by CNN was absolutely incredible. And we can't believe that it was just independent reporting. I mean, for example, finding these so-called ex-military people, we are told, and having them dressed up in their uniforms and calling for arms from the Trump administration. I mean, it's the same sort of playbook. You saw the same thing happen in Libya, same thing happened in particular in Syria. And so they have, in fact, learned what is effective. But, you know, they also have learned what can they have not learned what can bog them down. And what we are seeing in their policies in Venezuela is another replay. Unfortunately, if they are successful in generating a civil war in that country, that they will eventually lose. But in the meantime, it is going to result in the real suffering of many, many human beings in that country. It is really an obscene situation that we are watching unfold right before our eyes.
And Ajamu, you see a correlation between state violence in the U.S. and state violence being unleashed against Black people by the U.S. in places like Venezuela and on the continent of Africa. How so?
Basically, it is these are manifestations of the fact that non-European lives really don't matter, one. Secondly, that we are part of a global system and that the forces of repression and exploitation that impact a community in the U.S. that is has been designated as basically economically redundant and therefore subjected to systematic state violence is the same kinds of forces that are have concluded that it is a result to violence in the global South in order to maintain U.S. Dominance that they're going to employ that strategy. So, you know, we say the connection is made. You know, Malcolm said once, you can't understand the Congo unless you understand Mississippi. You can't understand Mississippi unless you understand the Congo. That kind of international perspective is absolutely critical at this moment in history. If you don't understand these structural connections and understand the dependency on the use of violence because of their legitimation crisis, then you're not going to be able to devise strategies to really address the issues facing poor and Black people in this country and globally.
Kevin, you write that, quote, on the surface, the report may have seemed balanced and neutral because CNN spoke to citizens caught in the middle of the political crisis. Yet there was no clips of the tens of thousands of Maduro supporters who marched through Caracas the same day that Guaido claimed he was the country's interim president. CNN also omitted the role of U.S. sanctions and other measures in making Venezuela's economic recovery nearly impossible, end quote. I find it not only CNN, but any, just about any mainstream corporate-based American media outlet that I'm listening to and the so-called analysts that they have on discussing this issue, it's all about Maduro is a crook, he's a thief, he's a criminal, he's got to go. There's absolutely zero discussion about, you know, it's analogous to this man is choking. This man is choking. Yeah, but if you took your foot off his neck, he might not be choking. It just doesn't seem to me that there's any concern about telling the whole story here. And whoever's listening, they can take whatever side about Venezuela they want to take, but at least just tell the truth.
Very focused here, and the issue at hand is the Trump administration's decision to foment a coup in Venezuela, and that's the focus. I don't know that anybody from any political persuasion, if they came to me, I don't know that I would really want to speak to them specifically about Maduro's policies, because that would distract from what is the problem. The problem is that there is a right-wing opposition on the ground in Venezuela that does not have popular support. I think it's very important to emphasize in this interview that this correspondent, Nick Peyton Walsh, after he presented his clip, he says, yeah, but there aren't sustained street protests. What that means is that politically in Venezuela, there isn't popular support for Juan Guaido and the people around him. And the reason why he has to call in Donald Trump and John Bolton and these cast of characters in order to promote their project is because they need to, through isolation, diplomatically and then economically, they need to starve the Maduro government of any strength that it might still have to withstand their opposition and break them so that they then cave and surrender and allow Juan Guaido to be president of Venezuela. There's a very real project unfolding here. And I think you know, what Ajamu's speaking to, too, is that this is a colonialist project that is unfolding. And we have oil reserves that are in Venezuela and that there are private interests who would like to get their hands. And there are people, there are oligarchs throughout the world who would like to lay claim to Venezuela's assets and use them. And in the process, dismantle a whole array of social services that are used by people who are in slums and impoverished areas of Venezuela. They want nothing less than to unravel the Bolivarian project that was started by Hugo Chavez when he was president. You know, we're supposed to forget entirely when you watch CNN that there was ever a coup attempt that was launched against Hugo Chavez back in 2002. We're supposed to forget any sort of context in history or that Elliot Abrams, who is now the special envoy, who was involved in defending death squads and their activities in El Salvador and Guatemala and other countries in Latin America while he was working for the Reagan administration. We're supposed to forget about all of that context. But the fact of the matter is that this project that is unfolding here is designed to give you know, corporate interests around the globe access to unraveling. And then also, one last quick point here is that you have the rise of right-wing leaders in countries in and around Venezuela. You have now Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, and you have Macri, who is running Argentina. You have the leader of Colombia. You have the leader who claimed power through an illegitimate election in 2017 in Honduras. And these people are pressuring Maduro to back down from, you know, it's actually not as full blown as the corporate press makes it out to be, but to back down from the modest socialist democracy that Venezuela has attempted.
Ajamu, you write, by supporting this racist, arrogant move by the Trump administration in Venezuela to determine the leadership of that nation, our folks are being transformed into not only Trump supporters, but supporters of the agenda of the U.S. European capitalist elite. I see exactly where you are with that. You know, if I go back historically, I think about the Anglo-Persian oil company, which is now, I think, part of or what became BP, and the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. I think about the United Fruit Company, which I think now is Chiquita Brands, and their overthrow in Guatemala. You know, Exxon Oil in Venezuela replaces Anglo-Persian Oil in Iran, or United Fruit Company in Guatemala, or whoever the interests were in wanting to steal the resources in Libya. And the same thing in Iraq, with George Bush and those oil heads wanting to steal oil in Iraq. We've seen this movie too many times.
Yes, we have. But my real concern is that, you know, up until the Black community was always the most skeptical when it came to these U.S. adventures, up until Barack Obama. And as a consequence of the real significant move to the right among the Black community, we have found that there is a degree of support for these kinds of interventions. So I'm suggesting to folks that claim to be opposed to Donald Trump that it's inconsistent to claim he's a racist and immoral and he can't be trusted with state power, but then turn around and support his policies in Venezuela. I'm saying we've got to begin to think about these things more critically once again and separate ourselves from the objective interest of the 1% in the ruling class that he is, in fact, representing here. So this bipartisan commitment to imperialism, to me, is a manifestation of their bipartisan commitment to upholding the structures of international white supremacy. And it has to be framed in that way, I think, if we're going to really understand what we're up against. It was quite revealing to me when you watch the negotiations or the conversations in the Security Council the other day, that most the way in which these states lined up, you had the European states and the U.S. primarily supporting this new government, this appointment, and you had people of color states who were opposed. So this racial component can be disconcerting to some people, but it's got to be brought into the analysis to understand what's really happening objectively.
We just have about a minute for both of you, Kevin, to Ajamu's point, to try to paint this as a Republican versus Democrat issue is really a misnomer, because both parties here are warmongering entities. A lot of folks saying, oh, if Hillary Clinton had become president, we wouldn't be where we are today. Look at Libya and who it was that was in Obama's ear to go into Libya and who voted for the invasion of Iraq. So to try to paint this as a Republican-Democrat issue is a bad idea.
Yeah, there's not much difference except for the zeal. I'd say that Trump is far more zealous than Barack Obama, but that doesn't mean that given time we wouldn't see the same outcome. I think it's just that Donald Trump's administration is going to be much more impatient about getting results.
And Ajamu, you mentioned Barack Obama in all of this, and there are those who will say that one of Barack Obama's tasks was to get so-called liberals, and particularly African-Americans, on board to this neoliberal imperialist agenda.
That was his role. That was what he was tasked to do. And he did it very effectively. You know, he set the framework for the backward policies we see in Venezuela today being executed by the U.S. He's the one that along with George Bush, said that the Venezuelans were in national security threats. So, you know, this is a ongoing policies on the part of the U.S. state. And the only difference now is that Trump is more crude than the smooth-talking Barack Obama.
Kevin Gastala, thank you. Ajamu Baraka, thank you very much for coming to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having y'all back.
My pleasure.
All right, folks. You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Republicans claim Democrats' voting rights bill is just a play to steal elections. The House Judiciary Committee held an initial hearing on H.R. 1, the For the People Act. Last night's hearing focused largely on the bill's voting rights provisions, which fall under the committee's jurisdiction. These measures aim to expand automatic voter registration, early voting, and felon re-enfranchisement. The bill also endorses a restoration of the Voting Rights Act pre-clearance provisions that were gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. Republican lawmakers, aided by their witnesses, suggested claims of suppression were exaggerated and accused Democrats of wanting to change voting laws for their own political benefit. Why can't people see voter disenfranchisement for what it is? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's been called the most important investigative reporter of our time, up there with Woodward and Bernstein. That's from The Guardian. He has broken front page stories for BBC Television Newsnight, The Guardian, Nation Magazine, and now Rolling Stone. And he's a true friend of mine and friend of this program, Greg Pallas. Greg, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Glad to be with you, Doctor.
You know, man, I almost don't even know where to start with this, but the Democrats introduce H.R. 1. It's on the floor for debate, and the Republicans try to make this out as the Democrats are grabbing votes.
Yeah, well, the Democrats are grabbing votes. It's called democracy. Aren't we supposed to try to grab votes? They're like upset that people are going to be allowed to vote. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It will help. So the Republicans are basically saying if people are allowed to vote, they're in trouble. I mean, that's okay. They're right. What can you say? Their response is absolutely correct. But, you know, what they're hiding under is saying, oh, that there's going to be illegal voters voting and that there's going to be alien voters and there's double voters and criminal voters and et cetera, their big voter fraud con that they've been pushing. And the problem is that for all these millions and millions of fraudulent voters have flooded the system, they can't seem to bust any. Chris Kobach, who lost his job as who's Trump's purge in general there, who's come up with all this stuff about, he literally said that there were 1 million alien voters. He had, as Secretary of State of Kansas, the only Secretary of State who actually had the right to arrest people. He arrested one guy as an alien voter, and you'll love this. This was a guy whom Chris Kobach had given this guy the oath of citizenship and then arrested him as an illegal alien voter because the guy had just registered to vote because he was authorized to become a citizen, but he hadn't taken the oath of citizenship because he's waiting for this big ceremony with Chris Kobach. So Kobach gave him the ceremony, became a citizen, then arrested him as a non-citizen voter. That's the only bust. That's the only bust out of a million voters.
And had to almost entrap the guy to do it.
Yeah. He's, you know, his one alien voter bust was actually an American citizen. So, you know,
that reminds me of that episode of Andy Griffith where Barney Fife is running around. Citizens arrest. Anyway, so Democratic lawmakers, they're pointing to examples of long lines at polls and the communities where the lines are the longest, voter purging, excessive gerrymandering. They are describing a system that is shutting out too many Americans and claiming that the system needs to be reformed. But the Republicans are saying that this is just, again, the Democrats in a long history of Democratic action actually being the party of vote fraud.
Yeah. Okay. So where is the vote fraud? I mean, there's a fraud against voters by the government. Look, I a few minutes ago, I was sending a technical note to the ACLU and NAACP Legal Defense Funds. My experts had gone through the voter rolls of Florida, the over 500,000 voters that were removed just before the race between Republican Brian Kemp and Democrat Stacey Abrams. And we found, and I can give you their names and their addresses, 340,134 voters. That's a third of a million voters.
340,000.
340,000, third of a million voters in Georgia just before the election, wrongly removed, 100% wrongly removed. They are removed on grounds that they had moved away from their county or moved out of the state of Georgia. They were exactly, we were able to get Georgia tax records saying these people, why would you pay tax in Georgia if you left the state, right? So we have the actual, and what their game was, what Republicans have been doing in 30 states is sending out postcards to people. If you don't return them, they say, oh, that's evidence that you've left the state. Really? It means it's evidence that you've thrown away a postcard, which you're sending mostly to minority voters. And not everyone gets these postcards, you know. So this is just one of the many, many games. I think that the Democrats need even more emphasis on the attack on the voter rolls, because that's where the big loss is. There's so much attention to whether the voting machines work or not, and that's really peanuts compared to the fact that of the millions of the brilliant voting rights attorney Barbara Arnwine, you know, as she would talk about, there are 14 million people that were removed, 14 million that were removed under suspect circumstances in the last 2 years from the voter rolls, 14 million. And yes, we talk about, you know, and there's a lot of things that could still be done too. And in fact, actually what's interesting is that while the Democrats are talking about re-enfranchising ex-con felon voters, as they say, Florida just voted to return people. It should be understood that there are about 9 million, by my calculation, about 9 million ex-con voters who are eligible to vote but have not been registered. Most think, oh, I have a record, I can't vote. Now, I want to warn people, don't register. In most states, you have to finish your entire sentence. That means probation or parole. But then you can vote. In almost every state, you can vote. And that's one thing that's missing in a lot of this discussion. Florida was one of the last holdout states with the old Ku Klux Klan, Jim Crow, anti-felon voting law. And so now Florida, that's 1.4 million people in Florida alone. Now remember, George Bush supposedly beat Al Gore by just 535 votes to become president of the United States. Now 1.4 million ex-cons can vote. And of course, in Florida, one of the problems with the so-called ex-con exclusion is that I found that there were, you know, like 58,000 black people removed who weren't ex-cons. They just had names, you know, common names like John Black, and so they got mixed with ex-con voters, and the state was happy to remove anyone of the felon color, you know, in their opinion. So, you know, we have a lot of, I think one of the things we have to work on is, number one, more protection of the voter rolls than even exists in H.R. 1. Second, once we have people having the right to vote, we got to get people registered and voting. And that's not such an easy thing,
right,
getting people back on the roll. So, and anyone listening to this, please check your registration right away. I know you've been voting in the same place forever and blah, blah, blah. You can go on your county or your state, every state in America, you can look up your registration online or 1-800-OUR-VOTE or to check your registration, to see if you're still registered. And if you think you are, there are millions of people who aren't. Don't find out when you walk into that polling station.
Greg, last night on the floor during this debate, you had Congressman Ken Buck, a Republican from Colorado, saying that Democrats have a long history of stealing elections, and he cited examples of William Boss Tweed in New York in the 1880s. He mentioned Huey Long in Louisiana in the 30s and Richard Daley in the 60s. And he also presented the false racial panic, the idea that the new Black Panther Party had helped get President Obama elected, that Hillary Clinton stole the 16 nomination from Bernie Sanders. So you've got all of this old, worn, all these worn tropes, all this old rhetoric, and I'm still not hearing anything from the Democrats about crosscheck.
Yeah, I know. And crosscheck, by the way, is on the run. Chris, crosscheck is that system that I have been exposing and exposed in my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is you can get now free on Prime. That's the system used that was used in up to 30 states. And now the number of states is falling quickly to about 20. Illinois pulled out, by the way, the new Democratic governor. Illinois pulled out of crosscheck. Mm-hmm. Reverend Jesse Jackson and I sued the state over crosscheck. It's a system by which it's racist, and I don't use that term. I don't throw around that term a lot. But this racist Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, Trump's good buddy, created lists of 7 million people that he said were voting or registering twice in two different states. People like James Brown, 538 guys named James Brown in Georgia, who supposedly voted in another state, because believe it or not, they found a guy named James Brown in Detroit and a guy named James Brown in Texas. And so what's happened is, yeah, so this is common names, which, of course, as soon as you get the common names, you know, black people have lots of common names like Jesse Jackson, and same with Hispanics, Rodriguez, Hernandez, Asian Americans, Lee Ho Kim. And so a common name troll is going to get you a lot of minorities thrown off ballots for no reason, and that's exactly what they did. And yes, the Democrats are actually – the bill is, to be very honest, I think it's kind of weak. I'm going to be right off. I mean, mm-hmm. I just – if what you're doing – because you know it's not going to pass in the Senate, so it's just a kind of think piece. So why not bust all of the games that they play instead of just a few little things and – especially things like concentration of voting machines. I'm going to be very blunt. That's a white concern.
Why is that?
Very simple. Black folk run up against getting their names removed from the voter rolls. They have the long lines. They have no way to, you know, they're stopped from voting, or you're, black folk get their votes not counted by something called spoilage. The ballots don't work. And, mm-hmm. and so you have a lot of this push by a lot of white activists for things like paper ballots. Well, I hate to say it, Michigan had paper ballots, and Donald Trump stole that because in Detroit and in Flint, you may have paper ballots, but they're read by machines, and the machines, 87 machines, broke down in Detroit, giving the election by 10,000 votes to Donald Trump. So I think that the focus on machines is very poor, though, you know, there are problems. We shouldn't have, like, push and play, pray, as they call push and pray machines like they have in Pennsylvania, where you have no way to audit the vote count or recount the vote. There should be a machines with paper trails, et cetera. But that's such a small problem compared to mass purges of the voter rolls. And that's not being addressed as strong in H.R. 1 as I'd like to see. Because if we don't bring it up in H.R. 1, which is like supposed to be our great fantasy for saving democracy, when are we going to discuss these things? Like you say, where is cross-check? Where is purge by postcard? These are the things that are devastating, and these are the things that Democrats voted. These purge programs were something Democrats voted for in the so-called Help America Vote Act back in 2003 when George Bush crafted this bill supposedly to help people vote and avoid what they call the debacle of Florida, which wasn't a debacle for the Bushes, and in fact gave them more opportunities to play games with the voter rolls. That's where the game is. That's what has to be done. And I'm also laughing. You know, half of H.R. 1's provisions, by the way, are about taking money out of politics, and yet it was Nancy Pelosi who ran her entire campaign to be reelected as Speaker on the grounds that she could raise more money than anyone
right.
else. You know, so, you know, come on, the Democrats don't mean that one at all. You know it. We know it. And you know, let's stop playing games. They are absolutely uninterested in taking money out of politics. So I do like the idea that they would have to, that all groups that fund candidates have to disclose their donors. I'm 100% for that. We should not have, we have secret ballots, but not secret purchase of elections. Because we do have laws against foreign, you know, now everyone's all shaking up Russia, Russia, Russia. But I'm much more concerned of the dark money that we don't know is behind some groups which are, you know,
right.
putting out poisonous ads, et cetera. That's the danger I'm worried about right now.
And you've got Congressman Doug Collins, Republican from Georgia, who says that H.R. 1 should be called the For the Violent Criminals Act because it provides ex-felons with a right to vote. Again, this is the kind of language that is being used to argue against re-establishing the franchise for American citizens. And it just makes you want to scream when you say to Congressman Collins, what problem do you have with Americans voting? That's supposed to be what makes America, America.
Well, if you have laws of the people, by the people, and for the people, so if you have laws that put, for example, people away for felony crimes for crack, but misdemeanors for cocaine, so the felons are more so become the disenfranchised. You have this massive scheme of disenfranchising African American voters. Our, as you know, like for example, take marijuana laws, et cetera. We've had in New York. Every single survey has showed that African Americans are slightly less likely than white folk to use cannabis. And yet 80% of the bus were young black males. 80% of the bus, young black males.
Right.
And that was the result of the stop and frisk business. Because you know why? Stop and frisk, I had no problem with it if you did it on Wall Street. But they didn't, did they?
No, no.
You know, it was very clear who was being stopped and frisked, and that's how you end up with these ridiculous extra charges, et cetera. So it's, you know, we know if American justice system were fair, it wouldn't be such a big problem. But we don't have a justice system at all. We have an incarceration industry, and that affects the vote.
80% of the stops on the stop and frisk were in predominantly neighborhoods of color.
Yeah, no kidding. And even within and even within the white neighborhoods, who did they stop? I'm going to tell you something. My son was like, who is pale faced. Went to high school in New York, and just about all his friends were, his friends were of color, all the mixes of New York, the rainbow of New York. And if he went out, they went out to play basketball, the cops would slow down, it was another stop and frisk scene. They'd see my son and they'd wave. It's like, okay, they're off the hook now. He was like the shield. It was like, it's completely insane. So this is the type of game that was played. So if you had a justice system that was just, maybe we could talk about.
Right. Absolutely right.
But on the other hand, making non-citizens, what other than Red China and Saudi Arabia, I don't know of any other nation that takes away your citizenship after you've served your time for a crime. And this is only a few states. Yeah.
As always, Greg, thank you so much. People need to go to gregpalace.com. Go to gregpalace.com. I haven't been there today. What's the latest story up on your site today?
It's about Roger Stone.
Okay.
And my friend Randy Credico, who was the source of who was attacked by Roger Stone, and so Stone got busted. I don't like Roger Stone. He's a bucket of scum.
Okay.
But the thing is, I know that, and I want to, this is important, when you read that article, you'll see what I have to say. Their real aim is Julian Assange, to try to shut down WikiLeaks and prevent it from letting us know the truth about our own country.
Greg Palast, folks, pick that up at gregpalast.com. Greg, PALAST.com. As always, thank you very much. Safe travels and look forward to talking to you when you get back.
You got me. Bye.
My man, appreciate it. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!